the sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Rev and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning and welcome to the Reverend the Rabbi. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Are the returns from Iowa still coming in? It's been some time, and I tell you, what an embarrassment. What a national embarrassment.
Make sense of all of that. You know, I get the app. I understand trying to upgrade technology and use it. But for something so important, that's risky business. I would think that they would try something like that on a smaller impact test place. You know what I mean?
And have a backup plan.
Yeah.
All right. Let me just say this. I read some time ago, after Governor David Patterson told me this story, that the Chicago Cubs in the 1900s had a great infield. It was Evers, Tinkers, and Chance. They were fantastic. The problem was that Evers and Tinkers didn't like each other. They didn't talk to each other after the game. There was a true dislike for the other. All three were voted into the Hall of Fame. And the lesson was, you don't have to like the person to cooperate with the person. And I think of that message for what's going on now in Washington, D.C. We don't vote for people to have a love fest. What we vote for them for is to get it done. And when you see the divide there is now, the nastiness on both sides, not extending a hand to shake the hand, tearing up paper publicly, all of that stuff.
Wait. Are you talking about someone specific there, Rabbi? Do we say names on our program?
Well, the millennials.
Pelosi?
Yeah, the millennials are listening and saying, what's paper? But on both sides, you know, president going down, not putting his hand out, she's ripping up paper. Yeah, these are antics. This is shtick. This is not what you want to see from elected officials. Get it done. And again, I know we say love your neighbor. That's an ideal. But in some cases, it's just not real. It's not going to happen.
Look, you know what? I will tell you, if we think of people in terms of adversary instead of enemies, it makes it a little easier. Because an adversary is an opponent. It's someone that you are engaged in some type of competition with, all right? And you understand the rules of the game and you play within that. But that's not how we're playing it. That's not how we're living it out. It is definitely an enemy. And the difference between an adversary and an enemy, you want to overcome your adversary, fine. But enemy, you want to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
You want them eradicated, totally removed. And that's what fuels the hatred, the anger, the demonization that we're seeing in this deep divide in our nation.
And I think what also is troubling is you have bases on both sides that are cheering on this behavior. So, you know, talk about playing to your base. The base loves it. They want to see that because they feel that's how you destroy the other person. So it's not, on one hand, we complain about they're not accomplishing what they need to do. On the other hand, we're applauding the kind of behavior that is just—it's just wrong. It's just so damn wrong.
Yeah, and it clouds our judgment because instead of listening so that we can respond based upon the merits of the argument, we don't listen because we don't like the person. So they could have something very important to say that can actually make a difference, but we don't hear it because we don't like the person.
Look, you and I have worked in settings where we didn't like the other person. It happens everywhere.
Absolutely.
Right? But you also look at the higher purpose. You look at, what are we here for? We have to serve community. We have to try to effectuate positive change. We're not going to accomplish that if we get bogged down with these petty fights.
Yeah.
There's a bigger cause that needs to be addressed, not the pettiness. And when we see that, and then we tell our kids how to behave, the kids are watching this stuff and we're saying, you got to shake hands, you got to be fair, sportsmanship, all that stuff. So wait a minute, you're telling us, look at you guys, look at what you do, look at how you speak, look at how you belittle people, look at how you tear people down. And I got to say, these are not proud moments, I think. When we look at the entire story.
And that's a great example when you talk about children watching the adults, because we teach a little bit by what we say, a little bit more by what we do, but most by who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they judge, and that's what they become when they follow us.
You know, one of the most powerful and popular statements in our liturgy, in the prayer book, is you shall teach your children diligently. Diligently, not haphazardly, diligently, by being the person you need to be so they learn from all that you do and all that you are. All right, Rev.
We've got a guest coming up.
Very good guest. Corey Johnson, Speaker of the City Council, representing the 3rd District, who is no secret to anyone, running for mayor.
Yeah, no secret. We'll see what he has to say and hear his story.
All right, looking forward.
We'll be back.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back to The Rev and the Rabbi. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.L. Bernard.
Reverend Bernard, we have the great honor today of having on the air the Speaker of the City Council, someone who's become a close friend to you and to me, represents District 3 in New York. But above that, and more important, he is there for all people in all districts. The ubiquitous Corey Johnson, and really a public servant in the finest sense of the word. Welcome.
And as a person, I mean, you know, his story, amazing story of how, you know, where his life was, how it was transformed, you know, when he had his moment, his epiphany, and in the context of his faith, and how it put him on the trajectory that he's currently on. So I hope we get to cover all that. We're going to have to get a little more time, Rabbi.
All right. No problem. Corey, he can handle it. Yes. Let's go to Corey Johnson, Speaker of the City Council. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks, Rabbi Potasnik. Thank you, Pastor Bernard. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have a conversation.
And I should mention, Reverend, that Speaker is from Massachusetts, my home state.
Ah, here we go.
So
back to
you're already getting someone a cut above the rest. When you have the matter of fact, his mom lives about a half hour from where I grew up.
Okay, and where's Tom Brady? Is he leaving or staying? What's going on?
Well,
tell me.
I tell you, if they offer me $30 million, I'd stay.
With me, Rabbi, you know,
everybody's
okay,
got
I'm
a price.
New York team.
Yeah. So, Speaker, this past week we sat through the State of the City. Heard a number of issues discussed. And one of the things that came to my mind is, you know, homelessness is a recurrent issue. I've heard mayor after mayor talking about it. Is it a problem that is manageable, or is it just something that we're going to have to deal with time after time because nobody's found a real solution to it?
No, it is entirely manageable. And sadly, what we have seen from this administration over the last 6 years is lurching from crisis to crisis with new ideas and potential solutions, but not a comprehensive and holistic approach to solving homelessness. Now, many New Yorkers encounter a homeless person on a regular basis, on the street or on the subway, but it doesn't tell the entire story of homelessness. So I released a report about 10 days ago called The Case for Change, and I worked on this report over 18 months. I met with over 100 different providers who work to provide services for homeless individuals and families, and the numbers I think would shock New Yorkers, because the often cited statistic is about 60,000 New Yorkers are homeless. That's actually not the real number. The real number is closer to 80,000, and the number of people who are actually homeless living on the streets is only 4,000 out of that 80,000. So there are 76,000 other folks who are experiencing homelessness in New York City right now who are in a domestic violence shelter, who are in a family shelter, who are in a hotel room that the city's paying for, who are in a runaway and homeless youth shelter, and who are in other specialized shelters. So the report that I released called for 70 recommendations on what we need to do to actually get us back on track and moving people out of homelessness. We don't have time to go into the entire report. I'll just highlight two things. The first is right now, our housing policy is not coordinated with solving homelessness. We have a deputy mayor for housing and economic development, and we have a deputy mayor for homelessness and social services. We need one deputy mayor, and that deputy mayor should be for deputy mayor for housing and homelessness. That's number one, so that our plans are coordinated, because we know that housing and homelessness is inextricably linked. The second major recommendation in the report was to say that the best way to get people out of the shelter system is to increase the rental assistance voucher amount. For the New Yorkers that don't know what that means, it means this. Right now, the city and state provide a rental assistance voucher for people who are in the shelter system. But that voucher amount is only about $1,500. $1,500 does not get you an apartment in New York City. Right now, we spend $5,900 a month to put a family of four up in the shelter, and we spend $8,200 a month to put a family of four in a hotel room. We should siphon some of that money off, redirect it to the rental assistance voucher, increase that money from $1,500 up to the fair market rent, which is over $2,000, and that would move thousands of people out of the shelter system and into permanent housing every single year. I was in Albany on Wednesday of this past week meeting with state legislators about the state stepping in and helping the city in the upcoming budget. And I'm going to keep talking about homelessness because it's one of the most pressing and difficult problems that our city faces now and is going to face over the next many years.
So people sitting and listening to your words are asking, is this going to cost us more in taxes now, or are you just going to reconfigure the funds as they're allocated so it will not cost more?
Exactly. It's actually going to save us money because we're spending a lot more money right now on hotel rooms and on shelter-related costs than we would if we redirected some of that money and put it towards rental assistance vouchers. There used to be a program called the Advantage Program that the city and state both put 50% of the money into up until 2011. And in 2011, after the Great Recession in 2009, when we had budget deficits, the city and the state both zeroed that money out. When they zeroed that money out, what we saw in the 5 years after that was that homelessness rapidly increased across New York City and across New York State. The biggest and best thing we could do is reprioritize some of the existing spending that the city and state are spending on putting people in shelters and in hotel rooms and redirect that money towards rental assistance vouchers for people to get into long-term permanent housing. And then the final thing I'll mention on this is for that population of folks that people see on the streets and the subways every single day, for those folks we need supportive housing. Mm-hmm. Supportive housing is housing that has wraparound social services attached, mental health treatment programs, substance abuse programs, things that will help these people that we see decompensating before our very eyes on the streets and subways in New York City. Two very distinct populations, the folks that most New Yorkers encounter when they see homelessness on the streets, and then the invisible population, the vast majority, the 76,000 people that are in shelters and that are in hotel rooms that most New Yorkers don't know that are there because they don't encounter them on a daily basis.
I think something that you just said, including issues of substance abuse, mental health, is important, because I was at a community meeting this past week, and the issue of homelessness came up, and someone said, well, let's just take that money and put them in permanent housing. But homelessness is a multifaceted problem.
Yes.
You've got mental illness, you've got substance abuse, you've got untreated medical issues, you've got traumatic events in their life, you've got violence and abuse where people are forced out of a family home because of domestic violence and abuse. You've got lack of affordable housing and difficulty sustaining employment. So it has to be something comprehensive in terms of a plan to deal with this issue. So I'm glad to hear that you've got various elements included in your approach.
Yes, and Pastor, in the report that I just mentioned, we talk about all the things that you just mentioned, because we haven't been looking at this issue in a comprehensive, holistic way from all angles. And we know that homelessness is preventable if you provide the support services and the help that people need before they get into a crisis. Yeah. And one of those big things we need to focus on is actually helping people that are struggling with mental illness and that are struggling with drug addiction. I've spoken very openly, and I've talked to you privately, Pastor, about
I want to get to that in the program. Hold on to that. That's a very important story. About your own struggles with substance abuse, but save that one, save it.
Okay,
so we're going to get that.
Speaker,
let's continue to with the state of the city address.
Yes, Speaker, some of the issues that you raise or the problems you raise seem to be things that have been there for some time. Why weren't they addressed more seriously early on?
You're talking about the mayor's state of the city this week and the proposal.
Well, there've been other mayors. I mean, we've heard about homelessness for some time. Why did it get to this point after all these years?
Well, I think there were some significant policy blunders that actually predate this mayor. We saw the beginning of this when people were deinstitutionalized during the 1980s, mm-hmm. and we still don't have enough long-term psychiatric care beds in New York City, in New York State, and across the country. We've seen income inequality that has been further exacerbated, and we haven't built enough affordable housing or supportive housing for people that hasn't kept up with the need. We've seen an opioid crisis that has really gone full-blown in the last decade. We've seen all of these things, which has made the problems that we're talking about worse, long-standing problems, but our public policy hasn't kept up with actually being able to address this, and we haven't kept up with it on the federal level, we haven't kept up with it on the state level, and we haven't kept up with it on the municipal level. And government, I believe, can be a force for good, but to be a force for good, you have to be nimble, you have to be agile, you have to be substantive, you have to be granular, you have to be forward-thinking, and you can't just talk a good game. You actually have to put policies in place that are going to make a difference in people's lives on a daily basis. And so all of the issues that we're talking about when it comes to homelessness, when it comes to mass transit and our subways and our buses and infrastructure, when it comes to education, when it comes to housing policy and economic development, these are issues that really require both, I think, a vision for the future of the city, but also require coordination at the federal, state, and city levels to be able to do some very big things. I put out a plan, and I know we don't have time to talk about this in depth, but I put out a plan about a year ago calling for municipal control of our subways and buses, and I laid out in a 104-page report how to get there. That's a big idea. It's an idea that people have talked about for years, but no one ever sat down and said, how do you actually achieve it? Besides using it as a talking point so you get an applause line, we need people to go beyond that and put together reports and ideas to lead the conversation and try to get some of these things done. That's what our city needs. That's what our state needs. It's not about playing small ball and tinkering at the edges. It's about tackling some of these intractable issues that have been festering for far too long. And in the State of the City speech that the mayor gave this past week, he talked about the environment. He talked about education. He talked about small businesses. He talked about the affordability crisis. All good things. He kind of put it in a way I'm not sure I would have put it. He said the city needs to be saved. I don't think the city needs to be saved. This is the greatest city in the world. The city needs a vision. The city needs ideas that are effectuated upon. And the city needs a competent municipal government that will get these things done in an agile and substantive and strategic way. That's what I'm trying to do at the city council, and that's what New Yorkers really want.
So I have to tell you, I have dinner with my son, and he talks about how expensive it is to live here. I have dinner with a friend who's a landlord, and he tells me, says, you know, being a landlord, it's not worth it anymore because I'm so limited in what I'm able to spend and have any profit. How do you balance those two?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the big conversations about the future of New York City. And I think what you're referring to, Rabbi, is there was a significant number of bills that were passed a little less than a year ago in Albany related to tenants. I supported those bills because, again, we have a record number of homeless individuals in New York City. A significant number of the homeless folks are people that are working full-time jobs but have been displaced from their communities. When we talk about development in New York City, we need to talk about development in a smart and thoughtful way. I think there are far too many luxury condominiums that are towering over New York City, and we are not building enough low-income, moderate, and middle-income affordable housing for the store clerk, for the person who's working in the restaurant, for the teacher, for the municipal civil servant. That's what we need to be focusing our public money on. And when you talk about landlords, I mean, I'll just say this. For a very, very long time, landlords have done really, really well in New York City. That's why the city has been booming in so many ways, is because I think landlords have been able to really, in some ways, prey upon what the market has done here in neighborhoods, and we've seen significant gentrification. We're not going to go back to the bad old days of the 70s and of the 80s, but we need to be thoughtful in how we approach these things. I came to New York City at 19 years old. I had two bags, I knew one person, and I was able to move to an apartment, an affordable apartment in Chelsea. It is now much more difficult for a young person who moves here, who does not come from an independently wealthy family, to be able to survive here in New York City. And so when we talk about these issues, we need to talk about the affordability crisis that is gripping our city and ways that we can build truly affordable housing, because the real question is, when you go into communities, and I know Pastor Bernard has a lot of experience in developing and building affordable housing, the big question people ask is, affordable to who?
Right.
That's one of the most existential questions that is facing New York City, because we do not want to just be a playground for people who make six-figure or seven-figure salaries, and that's what a lot of New Yorkers feel like is happening to them. Wages have remained stagnant while the cost of living has gone up, and the rent is increasing, the cost of food is increasing, subway fares have gone up, electric bills have gone up, the cost of clothes has gone up, while New Yorkers continue to struggle with their wages. To be a truly equitable city, we need to create more economic opportunities for New Yorkers who are on the lower rung of the ladder, and be thoughtful and smart with our investments, like we did with universal pre-K, which is helping a lot of working class people save money. Those are the type of things we need to be talking about as we talk about the future of New York City.
You know, I just want to jump in on at affordable housing, because, you know, the battle can be around density, but AMI, this whole idea of area median income, the game is changing now that New York City has a minimum wage of $15 an hour, because you take $15 an hour minimum wage, all right, that's $31,000 a year, $31,200 a year. Two people. That brings them up to an AMI of what, $62,000? And the current structure for affordable housing now puts them in a range that there is pushback against, because they're saying it's too high. But the reality is that these numbers are rising, and you also have a middle class of teachers and police officers, fire persons, you know, who are being priced out. They have these jobs. We need these individuals, but they can't afford to live in the very city that they're employed with.
Yes, I agree with you completely. And that's why when we talk about affordable housing, there needs to be a multi-pronged and multi-tiered approach. Of course, we need to set aside a significant amount of affordable housing for people who are currently experiencing homelessness, who are currently defined as living in poverty, or who are a low income or extremely low income. Those are individuals that are making less than $30,000 a year. But at the same time, we also need to build affordable housing for the folks that you're talking about, Pastor, the folks that have a combined income of $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, the store clerk and the person that's working at a fast food chain,
right,
who are now making minimum wage because we got an increase up to $15 an hour. We need to be thoughtful. And so that means that when we're targeting affordable housing, yes, set a significant amount aside for the people who are really struggling, but don't do it in a way that also excludes these moderate and middle-income folks that are making between $35,000 and $80,000 when you're combining a family's income. We need to be doing both of those things. Right. We can walk and chew gum at the same time when it comes to the affordable housing that we're building, and being sensitive and thoughtful about trying to cover as many incomes as possible on that spectrum, from extremely low income up to working poor, up to the folks that are middle income. We want to help all people in New York City.
Exactly.
And you also need people to invest, you know, in development. So you're accommodating all these different parties, because, you know, you look at your tax base. You need people, you know, who are doing well because they contribute to the tax base substantially. So it's a challenge, you know, and you have to find that right balance, which I think you're seeking to do.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that I think is would be sort of shocking and surprising to New Yorkers who don't live and breathe these numbers on a daily basis is I highlighted some of the more challenging numbers, the 80,000 people experiencing homelessness, 19% of New Yorkers that are living below the federal poverty line. That's one in five people when you walk around New York City. Mm-hmm. And poverty for an individual is they're making less than $12,000 a year, or a family of four is making less than $22,000 a year. And I could give other numbers on public housing residents and how the housing is collapsing before our eyes there, and on the disinvestment from our subways over the years. But I want to highlight some of the kind of good numbers that show that we still have an extraordinary amount of potential here in New York City. And what are some of those numbers? 66 million tourists visited New York City in 2018, the highest number ever recorded, and that's a really important part of our economic base here, and our tax base is attracting people that still want to come to the greatest city in the world. Our budget as a city, when I was elected to the council in 2013, our budget was $72 billion a year. The upcoming budget we're voting on in June, 7 years later, is now going to be $96 billion a year. That is $24 billion in budget revenue growth in 7 years. The number of jobs we've created since the Great Recession, 780,000 private sector jobs created in New York City since 2009, and nearly all of those jobs created organically, without subsidy, without tax abatement, created because people want to come to New York City. And so with that level of potential that New York City has, we should be able to balance all of these things that we're talking about, the challenging numbers that we're facing, but also the extraordinary potential that New York City has, and those are the things that we need to be looking at as we talk about policies moving forward and how to solve these biggest challenges that we're looking at.
Corey, you are very dedicated to your work. I've known you for some time. There are young people out there who will say to us, and Rev and I hear this comment quite often, why would I enter the public arena given the attacks that are made on you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and given the opportunities I have in the private sector, why would I want to make that kind of sacrifice for me, for my family? It's just not worth it. What do you say to them?
You know, I'll joke first. I'll say that you have to be a little bit, as Rabbi Potasnik would say, you have to be a little bit Meshuggah to decide to run for office. But, you know, I don't know. It's something, if you want to serve wherever you live, you want to serve the community that you love, one of the ways to do that is to get involved civically and maybe eventually run for office. And we've seen in the last few years a lot more young people running for office across the country. But there are other ways to serve as well. You can serve as a member of the clergy. You can serve as a teacher. You can serve as a medical professional. You can serve as a librarian. There are many ways to be of service. For me, I don't want to sound hokey or saccharine, but for me, someone who cared deeply about the civil rights movement and wanting to make sure our society treated all people better that were in the minority, I wanted to run for office to try to change the world, to try to make our world a more just and equal place. And that's why I decided to eventually run for office. But I'll say that you're right. It is challenging because the atmosphere that we're living in has become a lot more polarized, has been poisoned in some way. And what we really need is we really need to be able to work on all the issues that we're talking about here today in a way that's about symbiosis in a way that's about bringing people together. And we've lost a lot of that in our dialogue. We've lost a lot of that in our politics. Either you're with us or you're against us. I think there's another way that we can go about having these conversations and these dialogues. But I will tell you that it is challenging in the moment that we're living in to run for office, to be in elected office. I'm not complaining. I made the decision. I chose to do this. I didn't have to do it. So I'm not having a pity party here. But it is one of the things that I think you're right, scares people from wanting to enter the public arena because what they see happening on a daily basis in the news and the real lack of respect and the lowering of discourse that we've seen all across this country from the presidency on down.
Well, you know what, Rabbi, I think that, and only because I know Corey's personal story, I think that that personal story fuels a lot of his passion to serve and to do what he's doing. Corey, you know, you started to get into a little bit earlier in the broadcast, but I think this is a great place for you to talk about that personal journey of yours that changed your life.
Well, thank you so much, Pastor. I would just say, I am someone that was born and raised in a really small town, and there were 12 units of public housing in that town, and my family was lucky enough to live in one of those 12 units. I came from a poor family that didn't have much money, and I realized at a young age that I was someone who was gay, and that is what led me into wanting to get involved in fighting for the rights of other people. And when I came to New York City at 19 years old, I struggled living here. And at 22 years old, I found out that I was HIV positive. And instead of being able to deal with that in a healthy way, I spiraled because I was full of shame and remorse. And that spiral to me meant that I got involved with drugs and with alcohol at 22 years old. And for 5 years, my life was ABC. It was alcohol becomes cocaine. And I was in the thralls of alcoholism and drug addiction. And at 27 years old, I had a moment of grace. I had a moment of clarity. I had an epiphany because I did not think that I had a problem. When looking back, I clearly did have a problem. And on July 13th, 2009, I decided that I was going to get the help that I needed and I was going to be rigorously honest about the problems that I was facing. And so I have now been sober from drugs and alcohol for 11 years. It's my biggest accomplishment in life, and I did not do it on my own. There is a power greater than me that helped me through that journey and with that struggle. My mother is a very, very religious woman, and she is someone who always told me that nothing happens by coincidence. Everything happens for a reason. I come from a family with addiction and alcoholism in it. And so that has informed why I decided to run for office. I wanted to help other people who are struggling with alcoholism and drug addiction. I wanted to help other LGBT people. I wanted to help people who had HIV and who had chronic health conditions. I'm the only openly HIV positive elected official in the state of New York, and there's only three of us in the entire United States of America. And I've lived my life in a very open and transparent way only because I wanted to try to destigmatize and help give other people hope that you can run for office, you can be open and honest, you can overcome the struggles and challenges that you faced if you are rigorously honest about your situation and circumstances and you're willing to do the things to actually change and seek the help that you need. And so you all do that every single day in pastoring to people and letting them be honest about the challenges that they face. And that's what we need to do outside of government and generally in our society, is allow that space to be open for people to be honest about what they're facing and to be supported and get the help that they need. And so I'm grateful to be able to share that with your listeners. And I'm really grateful that both of you have been such wonderful friends and counselors to me to be able to talk about these issues in an open and transparent way.
And on this show, we are totally open and transparent about our faith. So you don't have to navigate that. By the way, Rabbi, he's Catholic, which
yes.
is, I think, is
well, also Catholic
Christian.
With a small C as well as a big C.
Hey.
By the way, I was listening to Corey, and how inspiring, and other people listening, going through all kinds of, you know, experiencing the wreckage of life, saying there's a chance for me to begin again. So I just want to say thank you to you coming on the air today. It was a very meaningful discussion. You want to endorse anyone for mayor in the 2021 election?
I'm going to keep going up there.
Humility prevents you from... I don't think it's any secret. Corey Johnson is going to be running for mayor.
I'm running, and I look forward to continuing the conversation. And I really just want to say your listeners know this because they hear you all and see you all being out there in some of the most painful times that our city faces, but also in some of the most jubilant and exuberant times that our city experiences, that I am just so grateful to both of you, Reverend Batasnik and Reverend Bernard, for your friendship, and not just for the personal friendship that I have with both of you, but you all have predated my time in city government. You have been leaders and exemplars of what's best in New York City, literally for decades, and mayors and speakers and governors have called upon you all to step in and help heal our city and celebrate our city in those good times and in those bad times. So to be invited on this show to talk about my own personal experiences, but also what we need to do to better ourselves as a city is just a tremendous, tremendous honor. And I look forward to continuing the conversation with both of you. And I love you both. And I love you both very much because you all are what's best about New York City. And I really just want to thank you personally and thank you for everything that you do to help countless, countless New Yorkers.
We thank you.
We thank you.
Speaker,
it's so great.
Speaker of the City Council, Corey Johnson.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Batasnik, the Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Batasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. What an incredible interview. The longest we've ever had, correct?
Yeah, in the history of the Rev and the Rabbi. I just want to say that I admire people who are ready to admit their shortcomings because, you know, we live at a time where some people think there's something very weak when you say, "Look, I have flaws." Especially when you're in the public, place. So I found that to be very, very meaningful, inspiring. And again, you never know who you're going to reach. How many times have you had someone come say, "You know, you gave a sermon years ago that made a difference in my life because you were talking to me."
Yeah.
And I think Corey's, you know, presentation also. There are people out there who are struggling.
And, you know, transparency is risky because the public is demanding transparency from their elected officials. And then when their elected officials are transparent, that same public turns around and condemns them and criticizes them. It's a tough thing, but I think transparency is still the way to go. And also, you know, it speaks to what we do, Rabbi, as representatives of faith. We take the time to listen to people's story. And I cannot tell you how many times I've heard a story that has changed my perspective on a person's context when I understood how they experienced it,
you know,
how they got there.
I often think when someone comes in and talks about the pain in his or her life, I ask myself, how would I want to be treated if I were on the other side of this desk?
Yeah.
What would I want the person to say, do, you know, to encourage me to improve? So you got to have the listening ears.
That's right.
Yeah, it's very, very important.
Yeah, empathy.
But, you know, years ago, I remember Edmund Muskie?
Gosh, you're going way back, yeah.
Yeah, and he cried publicly, right? He was transparent about his emotion.
That's right.
And he was pilloried.
Blasted for it.
Right. Yep. What a weak leader. How dare he cry like that?
Yeah.
You know, so transparency comes with a price for some.
Yeah.
You know, we admire it. Others abhor it.
Yeah.
But all right.
Great interview.
Thank you.
Next time, the Rev and the Rabbi.
I'm willing.